Hello folks, and welcome back to another episode of Miss on Sen with Xavier and Alan. As always, we'll be looking at all manner of film and theatre from around the world. This week we're coming to you from the United States, but let's say hello to Alan and he can introduce the next film to you.
Hello to my favourite fans and welcome back to Mise en Scene. Before we unwrap and take a bite out of this film, I want to make our usual disclaimer, guys, that our podcasts are best savoured for those who have seen the film prior. And as always, guys, spoiler warnings. So this week we're looking at The Founder, which is a 2016 film directed by John Lee Hancock and written by Robert Siegel. It stars Michael Keaton, Nick Offerman, John Carroll Lynch, BJ Novak, and Linda Cardinelli. So just to get into the plot of the film, the plot of the movie isn't overly complicated. Ray Kroc, which is played by Michael Keaton, is an ambitious Illinois salesman who is constantly traveling, trying to sell the latest and greatest of what the culinary world has to offer. While he's on the road trying to sell a multi-mix, a milkshake machine, he's introduced to the two McDonald brothers, played by John Carroll Lynch and Nick Offerman. When they place an order for a staggering 8 multi-mixes, Ray can't help but drive down to California and see what the commotion's all about. Upon visiting, he's introduced to a business like no other. It's filled with automation and precision, custom tools to efficiently and effectively distribute condiments. Ray is marveled by what he sees. The brothers have perfected the product line to get burgers out under a few minutes, all while maintaining quality. The enamored Kroc wants to franchise the business throughout the nation, and the story follows Kroc's ambition to see him evolve a family business into a multinational conglomerate. So, Saif, what did you think about the film?
Right from the outset, and people might remember some of my grumblings from when we did Unbroken, I was pleased that this film said it was based on a true story. It didn't try to pass this entire film off as 100% true. So, straight out the gate, this film had me on side from that perspective. Now, I like the fact that this film wasn't trying to ram fact down my throat. It was just sort of taking a look at elements of the history of McDonald's. But, I mean, this is very much a face value film. I mean, essentially, it's a historical drama. So there was no, I guess, great depth to be derived from it in terms of what the story was trying to convey, because by and large, the history of McDonald's is known. And if you don't know it, this sort of gives you a taste of what the history of McDonald's was and how it sort of came to be the empire that it is now, even though the film essentially tailed off towards the 1980s and 90s as McDonald's sort of boomed. It was very much a sort of a corporate history story. And it was enjoyable enough. I didn't have any major gripes with this film, but by the same token, it's not something I'd write home about.
So I thought this was a very interesting movie. For someone who's grown up with McDonald's, like birthday parties, there was a small amount of nostalgia, you know, that didn't really last long after the first act, but there was still a small amount of nostalgia present. But the film reminded me of The Social Network and how Zuckerberg is accused of stealing his roommate's algorithm to create Facebook. And there is sort of a crossover of elements of The Wolf of Wall Street starring Leonardo DiCaprio, which is a Martin Scorsese movie, where the use of shrewd business tactics to achieve one's agenda is explored. Overall, however, I found the film entertaining. I was intrigued with the character of Kroc and his tenacity. I fell in love with the passion of the McDonald brothers. I was marveled at the intelligence of Harry J. Sonnenblum and was eventually left feeling hungry for a Big Mac. But there are some great themes portrayed in the movie, and I'd like to unpack some of these with you, Sabe, today if we can. So just the first thing I noticed is how the film starts with this zoom shot of Zay Kroc. You know, he's doing what appears to be a speech for a sales pitch. The camera slowly moves away from him as he enthusiastically delivers what the viewer will soon discover is the chicken and egg sales pitch. So for those of you who need a reminder of that sales pitch, we'll just play it for you here.
Are you familiar with the notion of the chicken and the egg, Mr. Griffith? I mention it because, well, I think it applies here. Do you not need the multi-mixer because, well, heck, you're not selling enough milkshakes? Or are you not selling enough milkshakes because you don't have the multi-mixer? I firmly believe it's the latter. You see, your customer comes in here, and he knows if he orders a shake from your establishment, well, he's in for a terrific wait. He's done it before, and he thinks to himself, well, by golly, I'm not going to make that mistake again. But if you had the Prince Castle 5-spindle multi-mixer with patented direct drive electric motor, will you greatly increase your ability to produce delicious frosty milkshakes fast? Mark my words, dollars to donuts. You'll be selling more of those than you can shake a stick at. You increase the supply and the demand will follow. Increase supply, demand follows chicken, egg. Do you follow my logic? I know you do because you're a bright, forward-thinking guy who knows a good idea when he hears one.
So that was just a little segment, guys, of what Crock was saying. And I think this speech, or more accurately, a pre-doctrine marketing ploy, reminded me of. He's of the Wolf of Wall Street scene where Jordan Belfort writes up similar sales scripts with reading cues to attract customers to buy his penny stocks that he's selling. And I'm sure there are similar scripts that are still used in businesses or by businesses as part of current day cold calling tactics. What do you think about this scene, Saif?
I think when a film's opening scene is essentially breaking the fourth wall, I mean, the character played by Keaton was essentially talking directly to the audience. It's a very, very powerful filmic technique to engage with your audience, but it can have a polarizing effect because it can be quite confrontational for some people, and other people are like, ooh, okay, he's talking to me. What am I going to buy? What's he trying to tell me? Because it must be important, because typically when characters break the fourth wall to an audience, it's to deliver something that we really need to know. And I think for me, and perhaps for other audiences, it wasn't necessarily the information we conveyed was what we needed to know. It was the identity of this character, that this character was a salesman, that essentially he was struggling at the time, and that he was, by and large, going through the motions in what could be construed as an unsuccessful manner. You know, he wasn't necessarily doing well. He wasn't necessarily rolling in lots of money. He was bringing in, obviously, enough to survive, but he was very much a traveling salesman in the 1950s, and that's a hard slog. Door-to-door salespeople these days still have a hard slog, but for slightly different reasons. But I think it's interesting that you mentioned the dialogue is sort of this predetermined, he knows what he's going to say, it's very much a speech, and he just sort of goes through the motions every time he sells something to someone, and it's this chicken and the egg type speech, because I immediately got a feeling of that too, and I sort of went, oh, okay, we've got a character who's going through the motions. Like, it was very, very obvious, and I think that's really what was trying to be conveyed from the outset. This is a character going through the motions, and this film will be about him finding a new way forward to become something more than what he is. He's going to build an empire, but he's coming from essentially what a humble beginnings. And I think by breaking the fourth wall, we're brought along for the ride with him, because we are immediately made to feel like we're also a struggling salesperson. I think that was a fantastic effect, because as you say, some companies, or perhaps a lot of companies, particularly cold calling centers, do use scripts to this day. And I mean, myself, even in my dark days of career history, I spent 1 week, in fact, maybe not even a week, in a call center. And it was the worst job in the world. I hated it and I quit because I felt like it was a terrible thing to inflict upon other people, because I don't pick up cold calls myself. But it was that very much scripted nature. And I think that's really what they were trying to convey. And I think they conveyed that very well.
Right. So I think it's interesting that you bring up this breaking the fourth wall concept, because I feel like it's almost Shakespearean. We get this character trying to sort of show us his struggles. And then we see the evolution of him, you know, from good to bad, or, you know, from struggling to ambitious, and, you know, like all the complexities that underlie there. It's also like the way that he delivers this speech is what I find drawn to. It's almost like he's practiced this thousands of times and he's mastered the mannerisms. You know, like he himself believes in the product. Even if he isn't getting any sales, I don't think it's due to his inability as a salesman. And it's more in line with the client's requirements. So what I mean by this is, like, he's selling a multi-mixer. The client might simply not have the demand for such a product. So why spend like more money if you can't meet the demand of the product that you're trying to buy? You know, like from a person who's trying to service is a non-existing deficit that you have. And I think this is where, you know, he fails. He, you know, he might have a great product, but he hasn't understood the client's demands. And I feel like in business, you always need to know your audience. So maybe it's a product too well in advance for his time.
That's interesting. And I think the really key point that you mentioned there is that you need to know your audience. And that's a pivotal role for any salesperson in any industry. You need to know what your client wants and sell to that client. And I think what they're trying to say in this story of McDonald's is, okay, he had perhaps a revolutionary product for the 1950s. It was this multi-mixer, could make umpteen milkshakes at once. And yet not everyone saw the benefit of that. But I think what it was really trying to drive home was the fact that this was a man who didn't necessarily see his audience at the time, or he was trying to force something upon people because it was a means to an end for him. But that when he came across the McDonald's brothers, he had the acuity and he had the awareness and he had the ability to identify something in an audience, that he knew what was a good idea and what was a good investment and what to go for. And so I think that was really trying to outline the fact that while he may not have seemed to have had a clue from the outset, and he was all about using this one line to always sell product and just going through the motions, that he actually wasn't a silly man. He was actually a very clever person, and he knew how to essentially drive business and ultimately manipulate people. And that is a key sales tactic. You need to be able to manipulate people at the end of the day, because essentially what you're trying to do is convince them to do something they may not otherwise do by putting forward a good rationale and argument for them. In this case, a mixer, but in the grand scheme of things, McDonald's is a massive franchise that goes multinational.
And I think it's important that you mention the fact that we see the demand for the McDonald Brothers restaurants when they have an influx of customers, you know, and they end up ordering, you know, eight multi-mixers. And this is the event that leads him to travel down and, you know, be astonished why they've got this. He's having a trouble selling one. Yet these guys want eight, and you know he needs to see it to believe it. So I think what you said is very it's definitely interesting. So talking about a business tactic and sales tactics, there was a really good scene where he's in the hotel room, he's just hung up on the phone, and the camera's panned into a self-help vinyl, which if you notice carefully, it says The Power of Positive, and I think it's by Clarence Floyd Nelson, if I'm not wrong. I feel like the director purposely has that shot at the forefront of the frame with Roy's figure shown reflective through the mirror. And I interpreted this as on the other side of this man, he's focused on growth and professional development. He's molding himself and his mind to be in the best position to make sales.
It's interesting you make that point because I definitely saw that, but I also saw it as saying that this is a man who's not particularly self-assured, that this is a man who struggles. And largely, it's a personal struggle, whether it's that he doesn't believe in himself or his own sales abilities. Yes, he wants to be better, but he believes that to be better, he needs to work on himself because he's not quite there yet. And I think that was a fascinating juxtaposition that ultimately came later as someone that was headed up a multinational corporation, that even the most successful people in the world can come from very humble beginnings where they have self-doubt and they may have imposter syndrome and they may not believe in themselves. And I do wonder if that was an element being put in this film, because I mean, I don't know the history of McDonald's particularly well, and I certainly don't know well enough to know if the real Mr. Kroc actually did indulge in this sort of behavior as a traveling salesman. He may very well have done, but if he didn't, I think it's a very powerful story tool, irrespective of whether it's true or not, to sort of highlight the fact that humble people from humble beginnings can become very powerful people in the business world.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you mentioned this, you know, him possibly having imposter syndrome. I think this troubles him throughout the movie, and this sort of leads him to sort of be faster, more aggressive, more shark-like than anybody else, because he feels like he's got something to prove. He's constantly being berated by, you know, the banks, by his social club people. So I think that feeling of, I guess, a sense of worthlessness drives his passion forward. Now, we will get back to his tenacity a bit later, but there's this physical move that Ray does in the movie. It's very subtle, but it's quite effective. So just allow me to refresh the memories of those who don't remember it. It's when he mounts one leg on top of the car's bumper and leads forward towards the engine. You know, I'm sure this is purely for dramatization. I don't really think the real Ray Kroc would have done this, or maybe he did, who knows. But we see it done several times, and first when he receives the order for the 8 multi-mixers, he mounts the car, he uses the map to see how far he has to drive to California, and the second time is when he returns to the brothers and he tells them he wants to franchise. It's subtle, but I found it a symbolic of him trying to get a leg up on life. And I feel like this was an intent move either by the director or by Michael Keaton to indicate progress of the character.
I couldn't help but smile while you were talking through that, because I am a man guilty as someone who has a car with distinct protruding bumpers, standing on the front bumper, leaning into the engine bay, looking at, you know, papers, books, or even just sitting on the bonnet like James Dean. I think it's interesting that you sort of saw it as a way of him sort of moving forward, because while you were sort of saying that, I was thinking to myself, why do I put, you know, a leg on one of my bumper bars and sort of stand there like some sort of Adonis, looking lovingly at my bonnet and really thinking about something else? And I think in a way, like you say, it's almost like a conquering sort of thing. And I think for particularly an on-the-road salesman, of which I'm not, but for the character of Ray, I do wonder if it's sort of like the car and his means of an on-the-road salesman, that is his empire. And for him to stand on it is almost symbolic of the fact that that is where he is conquered. And that is what he will build on top of. And so in a way, standing on the car is symbolic of that is his foundations upon which he will stand and go to greater and greater things. That's just my thought.
Yeah.
Again, maybe I'm being overly cerebral about a, you know, historical dramatization of McDonald's, but I thought it was interesting, and certainly interesting that you noticed it, because I didn't notice it in the film. But now that you mention it, it does sort of resonate with me on a personal level.
Yeah, no, it's very subtle, but I do agree with your historical take on it. And I thought, yeah, by all means, it does feel like he's conquering something.
Watch out, guys. Soon I'm going to be the next multinational boss or something. I don't know what, but you never know. I stand on my bumper bar, so there's hope for us all.
Just take me with
Go
you.
Go stand on your bumpers, folks.
So just moving forward, guys, I want to talk about the failure of franchise. So when Ray initially opposes the idea of franchising. It's turned down by the McDonald brothers, as they say that they've already tried this, and they begin listing the reasons for their unsuccessful attempt. One of the reasons at the forefront of this failure is quality control. Restaurants weren't maintained with hygiene standards. Some of them were adding their own food items to the menu. The name of McDonald was being lost and wasn't synonymous with quality. So the brothers ended up shutting it all down. So why do you think the brothers failed in their attempt to franchise when Kroc ended up succeeding?
I think it's a bit of a multi-pronged thing in this. I think one part of it is fear. And they did make a point of saying that the McDonald brothers were a little bit fearful. They were fearful of one brother sort of falling into ill health again, and they didn't want it to be the cause of agony and potentially a life-threatening situation for him. He was a diabetic. I think another element of it is ambition. I think they just weren't ambitious enough to persist with it. They sort of went, oh, we gave it a shot once and that was that. Whereas people that succeed don't quit. They keep trying. They might fail 100 times. You know, it's that whole Edison with his light bulb thing. He didn't make a functional light bulb the first time out. It took multiple attempts before they found a filament that worked. Whereas, you know, in the equivalent of the McDonald brothers, they would have gone, oh, well, we made 6 light bulbs. They kept burning out, so we gave up. And the world would have been deprived of the light bulb. And so I do think that ambition was a little bit of an element there. But I think another really core feature of it was that they didn't have this bullish drive. Now, whether that comes from the fact that Ray was just a bit of an arrogant, bullheaded sort of bloke that could do this, or, you know, he had more of the sort of, I guess, sociopathic tendencies that allowed him to use and abuse people and sort of take their ideas and grow them under the guise of his own. Maybe that's another thing. But I do also wonder if they were just too nice. Their ambition didn't exceed or didn't extend beyond them just being nice family people that wanted to have a family restaurant in their local town, and they were content with that. And perhaps that was really the biggest thing. They were content with what they had, whereas Ray didn't have anything he was content with. He was always looking for more. And I mean, even in his conversations with his wife, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but she makes a point of saying, you know, we've got a good life if you just settle down and live it. And I think it's really important to sort of perhaps say that he just was never content. He always wanted more. And that the coming together of all his personal qualities and the lack of those qualities exhibited in the McDonald's brothers is what allowed him to succeed where they didn't, but also take from them that which was theirs originally and essentially force them into a position where they had to give it up.
So I think I'm going to have to agree and disagree with you here. I do think the McDonald's brothers had ambition to an extent, and this is where in the flashback scene we're shown they buy the cinema. It doesn't work out because of the economical climate, and they end up taking a page out of the root beer salesman who's selling hot dogs, and you know, they end up starting a restaurant. They end up fine-tuning it to a perfection, something that hasn't been done probably worldwide, to have a speedy system that of 2 minutes. But I think where they differ is they were focused on quality, where Ray was focused on that missing piece in his soul, which was that drive to prove people not just wrong, but give his life purpose. He wanted to be better. He wanted to just be the best of the best of the best. And I think you said it correctly where you say he had that bullish nature. And I think his wife has a part to play, either positive or negative. Let's talk about it now, say. So the first time we see Ray interact with his wife over the phone, while he's in the motel, after he's had a lot of unsuccessful sales, and we hear him lie to his wife that there are many interests in the multi-mixers and he's getting some great leads. However, it's obvious she doesn't believe him, and she even calls him out. And then, like, later on, officially, we meet Ethel Kroc, which is played by Laura Dern. And this is when, you know, he comes home after visiting the abandoned Phoenix store with the neon lights. And this is what you just said before, where she goes, it's a good roof, Ray. It's a good house. It's a good life. If you weren't too busy to live it. And as a viewer, we already see that there's a disconnect between Ray and Ethel. Ethel is content with her life. She wants to socialize and frequent the social club a bit more, spend time with her husband. The chemistry is diluted with sprinkles of malcontent and exasperation of Ray's continuous and what seems to be failed ideas.
Yeah, look, I think Ethel was actually one of the really interesting characters in this film, and I didn't particularly bond with her as a viewer, and I don't think we really meant to, because I think Ray is largely that sort of ambitious dreamer that's kind of away in the clouds. He's sort of floating around there. And Ethel's very much the realist that tries to tether him, to give him a grounding. And that really comes through in that sort of first phone conversation you mentioned, where she's clearly not that enamored with him. She sort of knows he's lying about how successful he's being on the road. She just wants him to come home and just be a normal man and stop chasing fanciful ideas. And I think that really becomes clear when you see the scene at the club that she wants to frequent more, as you mentioned, that he doesn't even really fit in there. He by and large dislikes the people that they associate with, which I think she's a lot closer to as a friendship group. But there's even points in there where Ethel's essentially made to be belittled by her friends because they're talking about all the wonderful places they've been. And she says, oh, Spain. And they're like, oh, when did you go to Spain? And she's forced to say, oh, no, I haven't been to Spain. I'd like to go one day. And Ray just sort of shrugs it off and goes, oh, yeah, sure. Like, you know, whatever. And so I think there was this very disparate relationship between the two of them. And you know, ultimately they do end up in divorce because Ray is this sort of ambitious, flighty person that essentially, I guess, uses and abuses people. And that's not just the McDonald's brothers. That extends to his wife, Ethel, as well.
Yeah. And I think it's a great point where you've just sort of like elaborated a little bit on her role in his life and ultimately in his success, even though she might not have been an initial driver for it. It is important for us to acknowledge that she did support him through the ups and downs, as she says, and even after all his attempts to break through and find that one idea, you know. There's a moment where, like, we're shown Ray and his wife Ethel are at the social club with their friends, and his friends are continually mocking and laughing in a manner to suggest to the audience to say, hey, what's Gamer up to now? And Ethel calmly and composedly tells them, hey guys, listen to this idea, it's different. So even though she might have not contributed to McDonald's or the McDonald's Corporation's continued success, she was a pivotal part to turn the attention on Ray. And as a result of this, he ends up getting investors into the franchising. But I think the line that sort of sums up Ray's trajectory is when she goes, hey, Ray, when is enough going to be enough? And he responds, hey, probably never.
I think that's interesting because Ethel really seems to be that sort of cliche, the woman behind the man, so to speak. And when I was watching this, and again, I don't have enough historical account of the McDonald's history beyond what we see in the movie, I did wonder if Ethel actually came from a relatively well-to-do family and that Ray was really actually beneath her, that he didn't deserve her, that she probably actually had money and quite a good upbringing in her own right, hence the things such as the social club where she fitted in, they were her friends, they were the people she associated with and probably had for a long time, whereas Ray was almost like someone that she had to drag along to that place kicking and screaming. And it did suggest that she really had a life beyond him that was so much more without him, and that she did her best to actually help him and support him and maintain him, but that he really didn't appreciate her. And obviously, you know, that came out later in life where essentially she had helped him in the early days to, you know, some extent in getting McDonald's to be successful, even if it was just personal moral support in that sort of wifely capacity. But she was sort of involved in helping convince other people to, as you say, buy into the business and be investors. But like everyone else involved in the McDonald's franchise, Ray just didn't appreciate anyone that had anything to do with it, unless it was for his own personal gain. And once he got what he wanted, to hell with you, and he got rid of you.
Yeah, I really like your take on the wife's financial background, because I didn't pick up on that, but I think you're right. You know, her frequenting the social clubs does probably suggest that she is from a higher socioeconomic background than Ray, which is why he's always constantly trying to prove himself.
I think you've hit the nail on the head right there. Ray is always trying to prove himself to someone else. He's not trying to make a better version of himself for himself. He's trying to outdo someone else.
Interesting. Right. So we can't talk about McDonald's without looking at the origins of the Golden Arches. So there's a scene where he's driving around after, you know, having a fight with his wife, and he sees these great institutions of America, the courthouse, churches, institutions that have a specific archetype, you know, like unique structures that make people feel good. And he's often looking up as he drives. So he sees the peak, he sees the crosses, he sees the flags of America, and he associates those archetypes or structures with emotion. Then he comes back to the brothers, and this is when he tells them, hey, if you're not doing it for yourself, do it for your country. Do it for America.
I'm just going to cut it here. I think one of the best lines in this film, and it sort of just kind of summarized McDonald's and by and large America of the late 20th century and perhaps early 21st century, McDonald's, the new American church, feeding souls and feeding bodies 7 days a week. I think that just nailed exactly what he was going for and exactly what it became.
Yeah. No. And I think this got me interested in to see whether there was some sort of science behind this. And I found this article by Paul Abizuri, The Role of Marketing, where Paul says, emotions are ubiquitous throughout marketing. They influence information processing, immediate responses to persuasive appeals, measures the effects of marketing stimuli, initiate goal setting, enact goal-directed behaviors, and serve as ends and measures of consumer welfare. And I don't know if Ray understood these principles when he was approaching the brother, but I feel like they had that association to make McDonald's almost religious, not just in America, but throughout the world. And I think now that McDonald's Corporation has superseded his initial goals, where you can't drive 5 minutes or 10 minutes without seeing the golden arches, you know, in anywhere. And I was once told that the GDP of a country can be measured by the price of a Happy Meal. No, that's true. But, you know, like, it's created all these crazy sayings.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
So just looking at that marketing aspect as well, I also found that according to QZ.com, they have a different take on this, on the golden arches. And I found this really interesting. And I think they were saying that subconsciously, the magnificent yellow M reminds you of breasts. And at least that's the theory that the psychologist and marketing design consultant who persuaded the corporation to keep its logo in 1960s, Louis Cheskin, you know, who was hired by the firm as a design consultant, argued that the golden arches should stay in place as the logo. And he was claiming that they held this Freudian pull for customers. Cheskin was a subscriber to like Freud's theories and on how sexuality like drives human behavior, and he believed that those impulses were a useful tool in marketing, and that maternal association that's associated with breasts. did you have a thought process on this?
Yeah, I did, and I think that's total claptrap. I'm usually the one to go pretty cerebral on things like this, but I think that's taken it a little bit too far.
Nah, you can say this is a load of crap.
Freudian people love to go down this path, and good luck to them. But at the end of the day, as far as I'm concerned, the golden arches are just a big M for McDonald's. And if you really want to take it one step further, I think when the McDonald's brothers themselves were prohibited from using their own name and they put a massive M on the roof to sort of signify that they'd been there for more than 30 years, I think it said in the end or some such thing, that the McDonald's that then opened directly over the road from them essentially went one step further and went, I'm also going to take your big M and I'm going to use it as your golden arches and really rub some salt into the wounds. And for me, that's where the M came from. It was just a direct attack at the McDonald's brothers and their new logo and be like, you know what? I'm going to take your golden arches, turn it into your new logo that's an M and just have a go at you and just drive you out of business. I think it was a savage, malicious marketing move by a massive corporation.
And I think, I guess we can talk about the evolution of Ray since we're talking about this, is how he as a character has evolved through this movie. There's a line where he's telling his wife, I'm not chasing them, they're chasing me. They're rolling out the red carpet, they're kissing the ring. And soon after this moment, like, Ray realizes he's running out of capital. His initial agreement is 1.9% minus a 0.5% of profit. So he's, you know, he's netting a total of 1.4%. It's not enough. He's trying to renegotiate to take a bigger cut. The brothers don't even want a bigger cut for themselves. And I personally feel like this a crucial moment in the narrative. And I saw the juxtaposition of the McDonald brothers to have similar qualities to his wife Ethel. And they're both content with a steady, sustainable growth. But Ray is not what they expected. And Dick says, hey, we've let a fox into the hen house. And the penny has dropped and the brothers are in trouble. And with the pace of editing and the time lapses, we see Ray realizes that the refrigeration costs are too high. His brain is evolving. He's trying to salvage his profits by introducing instant mix so he doesn't have to pay refrigeration costs. And we see his brain evolve into a shark. There's this great line that the McDonald's brothers, I think Mac McDonald says, is his bark is worse than his bite. And Dick says, hey, that's what Neville Chamberlain said. And this is a very important reference because they're referencing the interaction between Neville Chamberlain and Hitler. And they're essentially saying that Ray is the Führer. Did you have any thoughts on this?
I think it's that sort of classic thing about big business where you have to be a ruthless sociopath to succeed. And I think that's really what they're comparing him to. Now, obviously, in the 1950s, Hitler would have been a very relevant and very recent personality to have likened someone that was that ruthless to. So I think it was very much commentary on the time as to who you would liken it to. But it really, as you've sort of said in this segment, that this film really was about the evolution of Ray from this unsuccessful, relatively meek, mild person into a ruthless person, as I said at the start. And it is interesting to see that that perception isn't just for the viewers, but that was very much the perception of him at the time, that people noticed they were going to be screwed by Ray, essentially, as McDonald's brothers were. And I think right up to the point where even at the credits, they make a point of saying that Ray never, ever paid the McDonald's brothers the 1% share of profits that he had promised them, but that he ensured was taken out of the contract. And he gave his word and he shook on it, but he never actually followed through. And I think it was really highlighting the point that he had become a vicious, vindictive person. And furthermore, the character of Joan Smith, played by Linda Cardellini, she was the wife of one of his franchise owners, and he took the guy's wife. And it was very clear at that point that this is the time where Ray's not just a shark in business, he's a shark at his core. And whatever he sees, he will take, no matter what it costs anyone else, because he wants what's best for him, period.
Yeah, that was a savage move by Ray and something that was well constructed in the movie. Now, I wanted to just go backtrack a little bit and talk about him recruiting the families into his franchise. Because Ray falls victim to the same discretions that the McDonald brothers have faced when trying to franchise that sets him apart from the brothers. His ability to see value in people and turn them into assets. And that's the real key to his success. The first recruitment that he does is the Jewish gentleman selling Catholic Bibles. He realizes his potential almost instantaneously. I know that we've already touched on the relationship with his wife, but I just wanted to mention that scene where he's enthusiastically telling his wife that he's created a husband and wife team working side by side, making a great team. And I think that he earns for the, you know, for that team solidarity with his wife. He wants that dynamic relationship. And he tells her eagerly, and, you know, like, she doesn't even flinch. And I think had she had a different perspective, things might have been different for their relationship. But this is where Joan comes in. She fills the gaps that Ethel does not. She provides him with that courage. She fuels his desires, and, you know, like, he's a man on a mission now. I thought that was just brilliant.
Yeah, that line where you talk about, you know, husband and wife working side by side, I didn't even necessarily just get that that was something he yearned for. I think that was almost his way of having a jab at Ethel, just as one final check to say, are you with me? Or am I justified in my decision I haven't told you about to kick you to the curb and go take this other guy's wife and be with Joan? For me, that was very much him doing a final check and just saying, yep, you're out. I'm done with you. I'm finished. I'm moving on. And then, you know, lo and behold, ultimately, he said at the dinner table, I want a divorce. And that was the last we saw of her. Next scene, he was with Joan. And I was glad that they didn't show us anything more of that. I was pleased that they just sort of went, cut, cut. Times happened in between and things have moved on. But as you say, Joan had that drive and that ambition. And like him, she was a bit of a shark too. I think she saw in Ray that he was a powerful man that was going to start to make things move and happen and become very wealthy. And she saw a way to do better for herself. I don't think it was necessarily about love for Ray. It was about love for what he was capable of and what she would be empowered to do by his side.
Yeah, of course, of course. We just go back to the point about recruitment. He realizes that, you know, he's in a win-win there when he's found his golden goose, like, with the recruitment of families. And we see that repetitive chicken and egg sales mantra that we hear him at the start, but this time it's different. He's got a different version of it. He's come up with a new concoction. It's been revamped, and now he's recruiting families through all these institutions. And I thought that was a great cyclical symbolism that we saw come back to fruition in the movie.
Oh, absolutely, because, I mean, I guess it, at the end of the day, we all start somewhere and we bring that little piece of our origin with us in whatever we do in future endeavors. And I think it was really driving home that point that he still had part of who he was at the beginning there, but that it had evolved into something a lot more sort of driven and sinister in a way.
So let's look at the end scene now, when Dick McDonald in the bathroom says, why Ray, why you do it? And he literally boils it down to one word. It's all about the name, McDonald. It's the aesthetic value that apparently that the McDonald brothers didn't realize that has been the foundation of his success. I really don't buy this answer by Ray. I think it's more his tenacity and his wolf-like mentality and his corporate conglomerate greed and his Goliath stand on crushing the little guy with powers and lawyers and they can't even sue that has ended up being one of the reasons for their great success. But I don't entirely buy that it's the name.
It's interesting you mention that because I do remember a news story in Australia, probably getting on for a decade ago, don't quote me, and there was a little, I believe it's a fish and chip and hamburger store somewhere in Melbourne from memory, and they were called McDonald's. It was the owner's name, and I believe the store had been there for something like 50 years or some such thing, very long time, certainly long before McDonald's as a corporation become successful. And McDonald's themselves came after this little mum and pop fish and chip store in Australia for using their own name. And I thought that was interesting because it still drives home the fact that whether Ray truly believed the name was that important then or not, it certainly is very important to the McDonald's Corporation now, to the point where they will still go after anyone with the name McDonald for using their own name if they perceive it as a threat, even if you are a 75-year-old running a fish and chip shop. It's fascinating. Yeah,
interesting. I might have to look at that story myself. And now that we're talking about post-business shrewdness, and I want to look at this business, you know, like, from evolving from a David and Goliath model to a culture that was sort of customer-based model. Do you feel like current businesses now are more focused on quality and customer-based and environmental-friendly aspects rather than the old model?
In a word, no. I think there is a public perception of it, and I think corporations are going a long way to make that their public perception.
Right.
For some corporations, certainly that probably is their agenda because they know that if they don't have that agenda and hold true to those values, that their client base will up sticks and leave them. But do I think that is the model in general? No, I don't. I mean, it's a big world out there. And I mean, if you look at Western corporations, yes, they're a little bit more governed by the economy of a capitalist society, but there's a whole lot of the world out there that isn't driven by that and doesn't care about that. So I think, yeah, that's sort of, it's an interesting look at corporations around the world and how businesses function, because what's good or perceived as good in one country isn't necessarily seen in another one. But looking at McDonald's alone, I think it's interesting to note how different they are in different parts of the world.
Yeah.
Now, McDonald's in America, certainly last time I was there, which admittedly was a number of years ago now, we're talking probably 8 or 9 years ago, McDonald's was like McDonald's in Australia 20 years ago. McDonald's in Australia, years and years and years ago, started putting in little cafes, proper coffee stores, not just that percolated drip rubbish. They had salads, they had sandwiches, they had muffins, they had all these sorts of healthy options where they were already trying to change their image in Australia. Whereas in America, it was still all about burgers that sat in a rack for 15 minutes, unlimited refills of soft drinks, and percolated drip coffee. Whereas in Australia, more than 15 years ago, they got rid of the burgers sitting in the rack and, you know, tossed them out if they'd been sitting there for more than X number of minutes. So I think McDonald's as a business changed its perception depending on the countries it was in. I mean, I remember going to a McDonald's in London and they sold samosas. And it was fascinating. And they were quite good, I might say. But the interesting thing was that in this movie, they made a point of saying, this is what McDonald's sells. We don't change it. It's about the burgers and it's about the chips and it's about the milkshakes, yada, yada, yada. And they made a whole song and dance about, why have you got chicken being sold here? Why have you got burritos being sold here? How dare you? But McDonald's themselves have evolved over time, but yeah, still very distinctly in different markets, because in America, it really hasn't changed. And for the likes of an Australian or perhaps someone from Britain or whatnot, McDonald's in America is seen as rubbish. And that really is an interesting thing for McDonald's as a customer base.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that you bring up, that they've tailored their business model in specific countries to adjust and adapt to that specific country's cultural tropes per se. And I do notice, like, when I went to India for a holiday, that they had the Maharaja Mac, because, you know, like, beef isn't really widely eaten there. In Japan, that they've got more a chicken and fish based and different flavor profiles for their burgers. So it's very good. It's very interesting how that, you know, I think that line where I said, like, you have to know your customer base, they sort of did adapt to that and they did sort of move away from that specific burger fries model. So yeah. Let's look at cinematography, say. What did you think about how the movie was shot?
I thought it was actually a nice little film. It didn't have anything particularly fancy or amazing that, you know, was particularly technical or exciting, but there was just a few very nice shots. And I mean, one that really stood out for me was the bird's eye view of the McDonald's brothers doing their walkthrough mock setting of the restaurant and sort of trying to ascertain how it would work. I really like that shot because bird's eye views are seldom given in cinema, particularly when it's showing people in interacting and being engaged in activities. But in this film, it worked to great effect and really highlighted what they were trying to show, what they were trying to develop, what their concept was, where their ambition lay in trying to work out the most efficient and effective way of running a business so far as the kitchen was concerned. And I thought it was really, really nice. Another shot that sort of stuck well with me was the scenes of Ray driving around through sort of the Midwest America and across through Arizona, Route 66 and whatnot. And you get these medium wide shots of sort of his car and him just driving along in the hot sun and disappearing off into the distance. It sort of really highlighted the magnitude of his role as a door-to-door salesman. It's not like he's just driving around urban streets. He's covering a vast amount of mileage in cars that, you know, in those days didn't have air conditioning and whatnot. So, you know, you really sort of started to appreciate the character and what he was actually facing in terms of trying to sell essentially milkshake makers on a national scale.
I'm going to have to agree with you there, Sabe. I don't think there were any difficult shots, but the use of the camera and the angles were exceptional. It added to the viewing experience from the opening scene to the reflective mirror scene that we talked about before in the hotel to the bird's eye view shot in the tennis court. It added the emotive element of the narrative where we're seeing the passion and drive and commitment of the McDonald brothers to perfect their walkthrough for their restaurants from grill to table. And I thought that shot really brought out that scene.
Yeah, and I think another thing in terms of when you just talk about the kitchen, you know, from, you know, the kitchen scene to the burger and whatnot, I think that was really conveyed well where some of the shots were actually in the kitchen and there was a little bit of movement as the, sort of the characters walked through the scenes and we sort of tracked along the grill plates and things like that, because it kind of drove home the fact that this was a very fluid action, and by the camera moving in such a fluid motion through the kitchen and the characters moving around in front of us, we felt like, yeah, okay, this has a very smooth flow. This is very efficient. It works. It's synchronized. And I think probably as a technical standpoint, that might have been one of the more technical shots, but you sort of didn't notice it as a technical shot because it helped deliver the story and the performance so well to you about what the characters were actually trying to develop.
Yeah, for sure. And I was just looking at music and sound. To be completely honest, I was so engrossed into the film that I didn't really actively notice the music. For me, it was definitely there, but it wasn't integral to my viewing experience. And the one time I did realize it was the bar scene when Ray and Joan are singing that duet together.
I think that was a pivotal point. It was almost like a harbinger of the relationship that was to come and sort of the doom that her husband could feel. I mean, you could almost sense his anxiety that Ray was a threat. He didn't realize he was a threat, but now he was worried. But by and large, I agree. The music didn't really do much for me because it didn't stand out as anything above the film. And I think sometimes that is the best way music should be. It should contribute to a film, but not necessarily stand on its own in the sense that you're drawn away from the visuals and take it as a sort of an oral experience. But one point I did notice was in the little scene where we have compressed time and it's going sort of the bird's eye view of working through the kitchen layout, and it's going through a few other elements in the development of McDonald's in the early days where the brothers are sort of recounting what it was. There was sort of a peppy little jingle in there that boasted ambition and hope, and it really sort of resonated with what they were trying to convey. And I really like that because that part, obviously being no audio and compressed time, you sort of were forced to listen to it a little bit, and it conveyed the emotion of what they were trying to tell really, really well. But as you say, other than that, I didn't really notice a huge amount of sound.
Interesting. Yeah, for sure. So to wrap this movie up, The Founder was an entertaining yet ominous view of on corporate greed. It grapples with certain ideas of how one's imagination may be able to build empires, but also obliterate another's aspirations and livelihood. Keaton portrays the transformation of a struggling salesman metamorphosizing into a megalomaniac who is besieged by congressional fans and an enabling wife and savvy business partners while manipulating the loyalty of the McDonald brothers. The film is impressively written and directed with a soothing score to match. Even if by the end of the film you don't feel like a hamburger under the firmest arches, you will surely be thinking thrice before accepting a handshake agreement. And for this reason, I rate this film a 7 out of 10.
Just as an aside before we wrap this up, it's interesting you mentioned here whether you feel like sitting under the golden arches and having a hamburger. For the first half of this film, I went, I really feel like a cheeseburger. By the end of the film, I thought, ooh, McDonald's. I'm not so sure about this. I feel dirty because they screwed the poor McDonald's brothers. Maybe I don't want a cheeseburger anymore. But for this film, I give it a 6.5 out of 10. like you, I enjoyed it. I don't think it was anything brilliant. It was, as I said at the start, there's nothing to really write home about, but it was well done. And as a historical account, or at least based on one largely, I thought they executed it quite well.
Excellent. So let's tell the fans what we're looking into next week.
So next week, we're going to hop across the pond and we're going to look at a piece of cinema from the United Kingdom called What We Did on a Holiday from 2014. It stars Rosamund Pike, David Tennant, Ben Miller, and Billy Connolly. So it ought to be an enjoyable little family film.
I can't wait to see that, guys. And we'll see you all next week.
Yes, tune in next week. Thank you.